Today is Earth Day, and it's helpful to remember that the answer to many sustainability problems isn't necessarily more technology. When it comes to food, electricity, water, heat, cooking, and many, many other aspects of our lives, we already have solutions that require less resources and can be created locally. We can understand these under the rubric of low-tech solutions. And while we aren't alone here with our ideas at the Institute, we're part of a larger community. And yesterday, I was lucky enough to be included on a panel to discuss low-tech innovations for sustainability problems. This is the Low-Tech Podcast. Hello and welcome. I'm Scott Johnson from the Low Technology Institute, your host for podcast number 48 on April 22nd, 2022, coming to you usually out of the Low Tech Institute's gardens behind me, but it's raining today and here in Cooksville, Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us. Today we're going to be listening in to a panel discussion on low-tech innovation that was hosted by the French Embassy's Office of Science and Technology. This event will be a two-part podcast, with the second half to follow next week. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @low_techno. Like us on Facebook, find us on Instagram, subscribe to us on YouTube, and check out our website, lowtechinstitute.org. There you can find both of our podcasts, as well as information about joining and supporting the Institute and its research. Also, some podcast distributors put ads on podcasts. Unless you hear me doing the ad, someone else is making money on that advertising. And this is where I usually make a short pitch for you to visit our Patreon page and support the Institute. But instead, this week, I'd like to call attention to those organizations represented in these presentations. You can find links to all of their respective organizations in the show notes. Please check them out and consider supporting them directly.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. So I am Linda Michi. I'm currently a deputy attaché for the Office of Science and Technology of the Embassy of France, which is based in Washington, D.C., and in six other consulates, like the one we have here in Houston, Texas. So our general mission is to strengthen partnerships between French and American researchers and organizations from academic or industrial fields, and facilitate the transfer from technology, from research to industry. So energetic transition and solutions for climate change are one of the priorities we lead at our office. And so for this reason, and for in the context of celebration of Earth Day, we organized this event about the promising topic of low-tech innovation as a vigorous action needed for a sustainable environment. So this conversation is composed of two parts, and we feature speakers from both the USA and France in various fields. So it will be moderated by Libby Hsu, Associate Director of Academics at the MIT D-Lab, located in Boston, and a specialist in of sanitation and water treatment. Just to mention it quickly, the Q&A session is dedicated at the end of each part, and you may ask questions in the chat in the meantime. And one last detail, this event will be recorded. And so if you cannot attend the whole event or if you want to share it with your colleagues who are not here, don't worry, it will be shared with you afterwards. So without further ado, I will give the floor now to Libby, who will introduce the speakers and moderate the session. So enjoy.
Thank you so much, Linda. Hello, everyone. Bienvenue and welcome and happy Earth Day. The term low-tech can be surprising to hear at an event hosted by a science and technology office, let alone in the context of climate change. The 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which are promoted by the United Nations, provide a blueprint for peace and prosperity around the world that includes ambitious targets for innovation and for R&D. So you might be thinking, well, climate change is a pretty complex problem. Shouldn't we be marshaling our most cutting-edge high-tech resources to address the consequences of climate change being faced by people and societies around the world? Well, the group of experts assembled here today are looking at these issues from a very different lens, and they challenge you today to adopt this lens in your own thinking. Our panelists disagree with the idea that innovation has to follow a high-tech path that may be using expensive resources and infrastructure. Instead, they apply the principles of low-tech innovation to achieve sustainable solutions to climate change. And they recognize that there are billions of humans who have lived on Earth who have already identified many technological solutions to the questions we're asking ourselves about climate change, if only we can amplify those ideas and spread them to where they're needed. So we're going to be talking about low-tech today. And just to share my screen for a moment, The definition for low-tech that we're using to frame today's conversation is based on three overarching principles of sustainability, resilience, and transformation. So strong sustainability refers to these principles of efficiency, simplicity, durability that can be leveraged during the design process to create environmentally responsible solutions. Collective resilience refers to finding solutions that are easy to use, that are easy to maintain, and that are made with local materials to ensure that they're available to everyone who needs them. And the concept of cultural transformation pushes us to explore the context of technology in societies around the world and empower individuals while also contributing to societal health. So as you can see, all of these principles are intertwined. Keep this image in mind, because a thoughtful creator or disseminator of technology is considering them together. And this graphic that you see is certainly not the only way to define low tech. You'll discover other thinkers who are using terms like frugal innovation or humble technology to describe these same approaches to innovation. So today you're going to hear from creative thinkers who are based in France and the United States who have traversed the world listening to and learning from diverse cultures as they seek to answer these scientific and engineering questions about climate change and adhering to the principles of low tech. So they're thinking hard about the process of technology creation and how it can be more inclusive and not just the end products, because they believe that the process is also as important as the outcome. So we're so thrilled to see all of you here today, and we look forward to an excellent conversation. You can type your questions in the chat and we will answer some of them during the Q&A sessions. Our first set of four speakers is going to dive into this question of why low tech. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our first panelist, Philippe Biouy, General Director of Management, Research, and Interchange. The acronym in French is AREP. So Philippe, please take it away.
Yes, thank you very much, Libby. I hope you are hearing me well. I am not in super conditions in terms of network, but it seems that the high tech will help us today to communicate a little bit. And I apologize for my poor English or American. Yes, super. Okay, so let's go for it. So I have the very difficult task, I think, to be the first speaker and to try to dive into this low-tech introduction or low-tech definition. And I think that there are as many definitions of low-tech as there are speakers or people talking about it. So anyway, I will give you my own feeling, but it's also the richness, I think, of these alternatives into innovation that create really the interesting discussions. So basically, I have just a few slides. One is about why low tech, and then about what is low tech. And I think that I have about 10 slides. So Linda, in case I'm still on the why after 5 or 7 minutes, you can shut me down. So let's go for it. I think there are a few elements, basically, let's say 3-4. Big reasons from my point of view why the high-tech promises are not so great, and not only to address actually climate change in terms of reduction of greenhouse gas emissions or even adaptation. It's also the question of resources, biodiversity. I think it's not about just addressing climate change, but in a broader way. The question of the high-tech promises, like we can, let's say, go forever with the green growth and have electric cars and smart cities and smart objects that will help us to be more and more efficient and consume less and less energy and be in a kind of zero CO2 world that would be more or less the same as today, but with better solutions. And there has been so many progresses, we have to admit that. Okay, the chemistry of batteries, the type of materials we have developed, lighter and so on, gives us the idea that we can still struggle with any kind of challenge and be able to overcome it the same way the humanity has done it in the past. But in fact, there are a few elements that should make us very, very prudent with these promises. The first one is the fact that these high-tech solutions are consuming more and more resources, non-renewable resources, especially metal resources, about 60 different metals that we're introducing in all our, let's say, batteries, renewable energies, electronics, IT solutions, etc. And I think that about 10 years ago, nobody was really speaking about that. I think that now, especially with the COVID-19 crisis and some stops in the value chains at the world level, but also with the events in Ukraine nowadays, it's also putting on the top of the questions this consumption of resources. And I've put here a few. Let's say resource elements possible, but International Energy Agency, the OECD, the World Bank, everybody now is pointing the fact that we are going to make a gigantic extraction of resources to be able to feed the transition towards renewable energies and towards a more digital world. And it's sometimes, when I say gigantic, it's something like times 5, times 10, sometimes times 30, times 50, the quantity of, I don't know, lithium, cobalt, nickel, many other metals, copper, that we will need to extract in the next decades to feed this transition. So this is the first challenge. The second challenge is that once we have extracted these resources, we should be able to say, okay, guys, keep cool. We have extracted very much, but then we can just make the circular economy. We can recycle all these metals. Problem is that the products that we are conceiving, that we are defining, and especially the electronic products, but not only, they are more and more difficult to recycle. It's quite easy to understand, right? Because if you put something like 40 different metals in just in a smart smartphone, 40 different metals, sometimes just 1 milligram or even less, then it's very difficult at the end of the utilization of the smartphone to really recycle everything. Engineers are very strong, are very smart and clever, but not as much as being able to extract and separate and split up to 40 different metals in so many and small quantities. And the proof of this is that about half of the metals today, something like 30 different metals on the total of the 60 metals we are using, they are today recycled at the rate of zero. Less than 1%, say scientific people, because they are prudent, but it's something like zero. So the more we are introducing high tech in our objects, in our buildings, in our infrastructure, in our daily life, let's say, the more resources we need, sometimes rarer, and the more difficult to recycle everything. The third point about high tech promises is that, of course, we are designing, or imagining a world where everything would be much more efficient, like smart grids to be able to exchange electrons between renewable energy producers and consumers. We imagine smart cities, we imagine smart cars, autonomous vehicles that will be able to reduce at the end the number of cars, because we will be able to make much more car sharing very easily, etc., etc. The problem is that to install this and to make this gains in terms of environment footprint, we also need to install another world, which is a digital world with very, consuming 5G or 6G networks, telecommunication networks and data centers to store all this data and to be able to make the calculations and so on and so on, in a very, of course, everything in real time. And all this is consuming, of course, also energy and resources. And the problem is that we don't know really the balance. We know that we are consuming more to be able to install the digital world or to increase the digital world, but then we don't really know what we are going to save with these autonomous cars that will come maybe in 2030. So there is a problem here. And you know that the digital system, if you include manufacturing, if you include powering and cooling the data centers and your computers at home and so on, all this is already consuming something like 10% of the electricity worldwide. And it's something like the greenhouse gas emissions from more than the transport by air. So it's really something quite big. It's like 1 billion tons of CO2 per year. So this is what we are installing, and we don't really know how we are going to use it. And the very last point regarding the limits of high tech is the fact that there is also the rebound effect, that something coming from the 19th century, that every time we make something more efficient, a product more efficient, a service more efficient, consuming less energy, consuming less resources, then it is cheaper. And if it's cheaper, we use it more. And economists know very well this story. So that means that today the aircraft engines are much more efficient than 20 years ago, no problem. So every passenger is consuming less. But the problem is that, of course, there are much more passengers. Same for IT system. Every byte of information is consuming less and less to be stored in the data center or to be transported into the networks. But at the end, there are much more bytes to be transported and much more bytes that are created and stored everywhere. So this rebound effect is limiting the real capacity to catch the efficiency, the technical efficiency that we are doing, and it's not really materializing into the real world. So what would be high tech and low tech then? Then low tech for me is just at the beginning was just a provocation against high tech to say, hey, be careful because the high tech promises are not so great. And by the way, I would say that if you take the sanitary crisis, COVID-19, of course, there has been a very high tech response, which was, of course, the vaccines that have been developed so rapidly. And maybe you remember at the beginning, there were some robots cleaning the streets in China, some drones delivering food at home. And it was a very high-tech response. But at the end, 99% of the response of humanity has been just very low-tech, awfully low-tech, I would agree, in this case. But it was not about the behavior, like coughing into your elbow and staying at home and not seeing people, and etc. But it was really low-tech. And I think the resilience, you know, this capacity to answer to any perturbation was really, for me, the complementary of high-tech and low-tech. So this is something that maybe should inspire us for future. So for me, low-tech is difficult to define because I think an object can never really be low-tech. Like a bike could be low-tech, but even a bike, it comes from very high-tech industries. Huh? I mean, just to make the cables for the brakes, and it is very complex object. So for me, it's more about an approach, and the approach should be to ask basically three questions: why, what, and how. Why should I produce something? What should I produce and how? So the first question, of course, is the question of the why. Why should I produce it? So it's about the question of sufficiency, of frugality, we could say. What do I need at the end? Because, of course, every time I will produce something, I know the recycling rate will not be perfect, so I will waste some resources for future generations. So what should we do really? And should we try to focus the resources, the precious resources, where they are really necessary? So we can imagine that in the cars, we could, of course, go biking, but we cannot all go biking tomorrow because the cities have been transformed around the cars. But we could do lighter cars, less powerful vehicles. We could reduce the speed limit and to make smaller and smaller cars that would, at the end, more or less deliver the service and would really reduce the greenhouse gas emissions almost immediately, very easily. In the buildings, we could build less. We have so many buildings already in place that we don't use so well, actually, sometimes because they are under-occupied, sometimes because we could share some functions, and maybe the schools can also become the clubs in the night. I don't know. You can imagine everything you want to increase, intensify the utilization of the buildings. And you can, of course, also lower the heating or have no air conditioning. Of course, have a better insulation, but you can also just say that you will heat less and insulate the bodies instead of insulating the building. So you can imagine many things in consumer goods. You can ban disposable objects, make reusable packaging. Many innovation about this nowadays in France, for instance. Internet, of course, you could reduce the video or reduce the definition of the videos, use less the videos and the data transfer in mobility because it's very costly. It's easier with cables if you want to have to download a film or movie, etc. So we can imagine many things to have a kind of sufficiency approach. Once you have said that, I may keep the washing machine because I don't want to to avoid the washing machine, then you come to the second question, which is the what. What shall I conceive? Which type of object? And here, I think it's really a playfield for engineers, for technicians, for many people to try to build repairable, modular, reusable objects, easy to dismantle at the end when they will be at their end of life. Privilege the robustness, the simplicity, a single material approach. Every time you mix different materials, I think this comes to the smartphone example I was giving before. Try to avoid some kind of metal incompatibilities, alloys incompatibilities, and as much as possible reduce electronics, because electronics is generally a nightmare when you come to the recycling. So here, I think we have plenty of examples with other panelists for sure. And the last question is the how, I would say, that what, how should I produce? And here, it opens also questions regarding the type of production. Should I go in very big factories, gigafactories, can I have other approaches? Not for everything, of course. I think you need for steel production, for a refinery, I don't know, you need a certain scale, of course. We don't imagine that some people will come and produce steel in every village, like in the Middle Ages. That's not the question. But for many types, other types of production, like, let's say, daily objects, tooling, etc. Yes, many types of things you can use in a daily basis. This could be built into, let's say, smaller factories, very close to the production, to the consumption markets, and also it opens the question of the place of the machines, because of course it's very practical to replace a human by a machine, because it will work very well, it will not go on strike, super. It can work at night and at day. Yes, sure, but it's also consuming resources. So today we're, let's say, facing, it's a new promise of transforming intellectual work into data center work with, I don't know, lawyers that will become based on machine learning and so on and so on. But this is also replacing renewable resources, which are humans, by consumption of machines. So this is something we should think about and have a kind of techno discernment or technological discernment, that is to say, okay, let's put machines where they are really necessary. For instance, in hospitals, by the dentist, everything you want, but maybe not just to be at home with a refrigerator, just shopping for you on internet. And this is where we should think about the usefulness, and I think the utility of what we are designing. And I think something that will, I think for many people, at least I know at least some panelists, it's a very important criterion to define low tech. So that's, I think I've done my 10-15 minutes and I'm still there. So Linda, I think you have kept me the time. So let's say that, yes, to go to a kind of sustainable civilizations from a technical point of view, resource point of view, and to be able to address the challenges we have, I think that we need to orient. It's not about banishing innovation or even technical innovation, but I think it's just to say, let's put innovation with a certain goal, and this goal should be the reduction of the environmental footprint, should be the resilience, and we are far from that. Look at the tens of thousands of engineers that Mark Zuckerberg is hiring now to make the metaverse world, I think, which is just something crazy that we don't really need to be happy, I think. And by the way, we'll not save anything, including the planet, but we'll consume for sure many, many data. And even if there are some progress and technical steps in the way the data centers are consuming energy. So I think this is something that we should think about, that we have a kind of, let's raise the right questions. Just not designing something just because I can sell it. No, we should think about the usefulness. We should think about the goals and think that innovation is something else than just technical innovation. It can be organizational, cultural innovation. For example, just having, let's say, cleaning empty bottles and putting new stuff into the bottle is something that has no technical challenge for that. I mean, cleaning a bottle is very easy, but just putting people together, consumers, producers, and logistic chain, storing, etc., all this then becomes quite complex. And then that means that the solutions we should develop as engineers and as everybody, as marketers and so on, we should develop socio-technical solutions, not technical solutions. I think the behavior, having people on board, will be very important. And this is, I think, what low-tech DNA is, more or less. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Philippe, for that excellent introduction and for posing those three questions to us to think about as we continue discussing low tech. So without further ado, we'll move on to our next speaker, Corentin de Châteauperron, who is the co-founder of the Low Tech Lab and is speaking to us from outside New York.
Okay, thank you, Linda, for the presentation. So yeah, I'm a member of the Low Tech Lab, which is a nonprofit, a French organization. And the goal of the Low Tech Lab is to find low tech innovation, to test them, to document and promote them so that anyone can replicate them. The idea is to focus on local entrepreneurship so that people all around the world can take those knowledge and adapt them to their local economy, to their local culture, with their local means and resources and everything. And we want to, our definition is, as you said, Linda, on what explained Philippe, we use exactly the same, and we condense it into three words: useful, accessible, and sustainable. And so we started our next one, Linda, please. Thanks. We started in 2013 by creating a website, which is a kind of wiki. That means it's open source and collaborative, and there are tutorials on it, on each technology that we document. There are like something like 150 different technologies or know-hows. It's called lowtechlab.org, if you want to have a look. And in 2016, next slide, please, Linda. We started a journey around the world. With this boat, it's a kind of floating laboratory. We are now on board with close to New York, and we'll cross soon the Atlantic Ocean to go back to France. And we started in 2016, and we've been in 25 countries and documented more than 50 different low tech. So I won't explain the 50 low tech that we found. It would be too long, but I've selected three examples. Next one, Linda, please. One of my favorites was the black soldier fly. We studied that in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. It's a fly that is really incredible because the larvae of this fly can transform very efficiently organic waste into fertilizer, and we can harvest the larvae to feed animals. And they were using it at a quite large scale in Kuala Lumpur. They were transforming 300 tons of waste, organic waste, every day into fertilizer to grow food and also to feed some fish with the larvae. And it's good for different issues, the waste management, because the organic waste are burnt or put with other kinds of waste in the ground. So thanks to those larvae, it makes two resources, one side the fertilizer and the other side the food. And another issue is that feeding fish or chicken with those larvae avoid to overfish in the Bay of Bengal over there. And also it creates a local economy. So it's a good example also of low tech we discovered, because you can spread the knowledge at a small scale. We even have on board on the boat a small black soldier fly farm to treat a very small quantity of organic waste, but you can do it at large scale. So it's good for local entrepreneurs that can start with just a few dollars a farm and then raise it. And other example, Linda, can you put the next slide, was the biodigester. This one was in Nicaragua, but we also found biodigester in many countries, like in France, in Brazil, in South Africa, in Madagascar, in India, in Cuba, that was in Nicaragua. And it also transforms organic waste, but it makes gas for like cooking gas, and so energy, and also a fertilizer. And it's a combination with, a collaboration with nature because it uses bacteria and microorganisms to produce the gas. And the next slide, Linda. This is, it was in Cuba about communication. Over there, they don't have easy access to the internet. It's quite expensive. It's not affordable. So they made quite huge local networks. It's intranet. That means they install antennas and people can send data. Like if you send an email, a picture to someone, like if you want to send it in France to your neighbor, it will go to your data center, to the data center of your email, host or something. And then it will be downloaded to another data center of the email provider of your neighbor. And then it will be downloaded to the computer of your neighbor. Thanks to this kind of antenna that they install in Cuba, you can directly send it through this antenna to your neighbor. And so next, those are only three examples, but so we met many people on many solutions. We documented many solutions around the world. And at the end of the tour, and I was trying to find in a few words what we learned during this tour about all those low tech. I found four things. So next slide, Linda, please. The first one is that we are more and more convinced that it's good to focus on local entrepreneurship and just spread the knowledge, because it's much more resilient and sustainable to do like that, because people can adapt the knowledge and implement the technology regarding their own culture and economy and way of life and everything. And it's much more resilient. Number two is the next slide. It's again the I like this fly. I'm a mechanical engineer and I didn't know anything about nature before starting this journey. And I found that collaborations with nature, like this larvae, but also with the microorganism, with the mushrooms, with vegetables, with many living things, are much more efficient than man-made machines. And so we should reinforce our links with nature if we want to keep the low-tech philosophy in our progress. And which is not actually reinforcing our links with nature is not really the current trend. And number three is the next slide. One of the main obstacles of the low tech we found is they are not very well designed and they are not very convenient. And this is a picture about the movie about the first computers. It reminds me actually the first computer, because we see in each of those low tech a huge potential, but most of them are made by geeks in their garage, and we have to work a lot on designing them and making them more convenient. And the next slide, Linda, please. It's not a low-tech picture, but meaning that, as I don't know who said that, but it's smart, I think, that present is the consequence of the future. Actually, the way we imagine our future has a huge impact on our everyday decisions. And so if we want that people adapt low-tech, I think we have to design a real low-tech future. That is not like this picture, but I mean, it's much more than a technical challenge. It's also designing a way of life, a philosophy around it. And that can drive people to adapt low tech. And I think for the moment, it's more like a bit too much geeks in their garage. And so I think we need to evolve in that. That's all I learned to be short.
What a great ending. Thank you so much, Quentin, and thank you for sharing your just a slice of your amazing travels with us. Fascinating. Our next panelist is Scott Johnson, co-founder and director of the Low Tech Institute in Wisconsin, moving across the Atlantic to the US.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on this discussion today. And I realize in such a short time, none of us can really get too deep into detail of all the work we're doing. And I feel like we're just scratching the surface. So today I'm going to talk about food, which for me is one of the most important legs of the stool that supports complex societies. The French Revolution, French embassy, will remember coincided with a wheat crisis. So food is very, very important for everything we're talking about. And with this group, I don't have to go into detail to describe how dependent our modern agricultural system is on fossil fuels and long distance transportation. I don't need to say how it decreases our resilience in the face of unexpected catastrophes, both man-made and natural, and that governments have no realistic plans for large-scale transitions. So today, I'm going to talk about ideas to encourage redundant, resilient regional food systems, that is, small-scale transitions, and that's plural transitions, because there's lots of different options we could use. The truth is, we've lived in a very unusual historical period. Few of us have known food insecurity on a national scale. And while this is truly lucky for all of us, it makes our societies susceptible to hubris when it comes to food. We don't think that famine could happen to us. So many large nations have gotten rid of their strategic grain supplies. For example, in the United States, we sold our strategic grain reserve under Reagan. The idea was to put the money in the stock market, thinking that during a time of famine, we could just buy more food from somewhere else. I tried to come up with a polite way to say that this is idiotic, but it's just so stupid, I can't wrap my mind around it. This is hubris on an international scale. And so I run the Low Technology Institute, which is a research and education nonprofit in the United States. And our guiding principle is that fossil fuels are a finite resource and we should plan for their end as soon as possible. In the case of oil, we're talking 25 years of usable reserves. There's more, but we're not going to dig it all out. This change then is coming in our lifetimes. And this is going to radically change how we transport people and goods around the globe. It'll radically reduce the amount of fertilizer for crops, and it will radically reduce the motive power, the tractors and things in agriculture. And so we advocate for people to build locally redundant systems into their lives now so they're able to transition smoothly to a future without fossil fuels. And we talk about this for not just food, energy, construction methods and materials, clothing, everything else we need to thrive today in our lives. And right now, I'm going to outline briefly what we've been discussing as one viable way for future communities to feed themselves. It's not the only one, but it's kind of what we've been talking about. And I'm going to focus on why things need to be local, seasonal, and personal. And for me, it all comes down to redundant, resilient, and above all, local systems. If you source your staple food from farther away than you can walk or ride a bicycle or a horse, you are dependent on external transportation for your food. And maybe we'll be able to electrify the transportation networks to such a point that local food is indeed redundant. But until that system has been in place and well-tested through natural and other disasters for many years, I'm not going to risk the health and food of my family and community on this new system. And that means people have to start growing more food personally. And I found this great French postcard of the future of agriculture. I was an archaeologist once upon a time, and so I often look to the past. And I know that in past societies, 90% of humans living in sedentary societies were full-time food producers, peasants and farmers. Only a tenth of society was able to get by on crafts and administrative work. And I don't think we have to go back to this type of severe ratio of farmers to craftspeople, because our understanding of the natural world and agricultural science in particular have advanced. But we would be able to feed ourselves and maintain a complex economy if most adults were to split their time evenly between skilled labor and home food production and provision. And that doesn't just include growing the food, but also preserving it and cooking it. Again, that's adults working maybe 20 hours a week in food production, preservation, and preparation, and 20 hours in a skilled trade. And if you think about it, that's kind of what we used to do. We used to have one person working out of the house and one person working at home. This split is not impossible for a high functioning economy. And I know this division would work because we tried it. We did it in January 2020, before we knew that COVID would become a worldwide pandemic. We decided to see if we could grow all our own food locally and without fossil fuels. We chronicled it all on our YouTube page, also on our website. You can find that under Foodmageddon. My wife worked 40 hours a week, and I grew all of our food. And in that year, I was able to grow all of our food for an entire year in less than 40 hours a week. And while this is only a simulation, it provides a lot of useful data, and it's anecdotal, but it's still data. And it also let me check out the opinions and theoretical constructs I've been talking about for so long and put them into practice. And so it would be entirely possible to spend your morning working on a skilled trade. And I ran my nonprofit in the mornings, and in the afternoons I would grow food. And we did this on a small plot. We don't live on a large, you know, we live in the country, but we live in a pretty tight community. And so we don't have 20 acres to do this. Our entire property is only 3/4 of an acre, with an additional 1/2 acre next door. The total land under cultivation is less than 3/4 of an acre, or 3/10 of a hectare. And on that plot, we grew everything from wheat, rye, potatoes, corn, and oats as our staple crops. And we also grew a lot of our typical garden plants to make our food more exciting to eat. Warm tomato soup in the middle of a Wisconsin winter is a really great way to end your day. And we are able to grow much of this food without mechanization and using less of our time than you might think. We grew more than 1 million calories in a year, and we actually grew a lot more than that. We didn't know what was going to happen with COVID, so we actually grew thousands of pounds of potatoes because we didn't know if we'd have to be giving them to our neighbors in the fall. We ended up giving them to a food pantry, but the easy ability for us to produce such a large amount of food in such a small amount of time and space speaks to the underutilized resource that is a lot of the space around us. Even in a suburban American neighborhood, which you think is very unsustainable, they have a lot of space around them. They could be growing a lot of food to support themselves. This type of food production is only possible if we have the right variety of plants available, and meals also to reflect the seasonality of our planet. My first year harvesting wheat, for example, was done using varieties created for industrial production, and they didn't really lend themselves to hand harvesting. I learned that the hard way. And furthermore, the wheat that came out of these varieties had a really high bran content, and so it wasn't very good for making flour. Since then, I've adopted heritage wheat and other heirloom varieties that not only breed true, but were developed at a time when heavy fertilizer additions were not available. If you're familiar with the Open Source Seed Initiative, one of the things they're into is, just like open source software, being able to share seeds that are reproduced without, they're non-hybrid seeds, that if you share them, you have to promise that you will let anyone else breed them and share them as well. And home production lends itself to seasonal eating. Without long distance transport, we're relying on fresh foods in the summer and fall and stored foods in the winter and spring. And they say in English, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And at this point in the year, we're almost out of potatoes, which is good because we eat potatoes almost every other day or every day, and I need a break. But by the fall, I'm going to be excited to eat potatoes again. Just like I'm excited to eat lettuce now, even though by the end of the summer, I'll be sick of it. Seasonal eating keeps things exciting. Another thing to consider is the learning curve. It's taken me many years to figure out how to feed our family from our plot. And we cannot wait until we're facing a crisis to try and start doing this. We can't wait until we're transitioning away from fossil fuels and long distance transportation of our staple crops. If we wait and face a crisis, it is too late. We have to start to plan and build redundant systems now. For example, this fall, I anticipate the wheat market's going to be severely disrupted by the embargo on Russian wheat and the destruction of the Ukrainian wheat harvest, which is 15% of global wheat. Not to mention the loss of Russian and Belarusian fertilizers on the international market, which is causing problems already with this year's crop. By growing staples at a local level, we create redundant systems. And in English, we have the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And this means to spread out your risk, to avoid losing everything when you drop that basket. And by having diverse, dispersed agriculture, failure in one locality doesn't spell disaster for everyone. Redundant systems, though, are not economically advantageous. And I don't know about you, but I can't eat economic advantage. Every year, there's more evidence and more reason to think about transitioning and building more redundant and therefore more resilient systems locally now. And I do realize I'm getting to the end here, so I want to end with this thought. Nobody is self-sufficient. And I'm trying to stop using that phrase. A friend of mine, Bill Robichaud, pointed out to me, he's more poetic than I am, nobody is self-sufficient. We all depend on one another and healthy ecosystems around us. In the future, we're going to have to depend more heavily on local communities. And it's not only important to be able to do these things for yourself and your family, but also to support those around you and show them how. And now is the time. Now is the time to convince and show other people around you that this way of life with local personally grown food is not only possible, but it's better. It's attractive. We grow most of our food in less time than most people think. They see my garden, they say, geez, how much time do you spend? It's a few hours a day, if that. And we eat really well because we have the luxury of being able to make it all at home. We don't have to worry about paying a premium for organic or other ecologically friendly farming practices. It's built into our system because we don't use fossil fuels. Sometimes we feel really alone when we say these things. So it's nice to hear from other folks on this panel singing in the same choir, even if we are far apart. But finally, I do want to point out that we need to think carefully about those who don't agree with our approach, because we can convince, you know, a few people here and there, but we need to get a societal change happening. And there's a lot of people in our societies that willfully disregard the fact that we're facing a real problem and it's coming sooner than I think most people understand. So with that, I'll end and thank you so much for your attention. And I'm looking forward to hearing what everyone else has to say and share.
Thank you so much, Scott. That was a fascinating presentation. And thank you for teaching us the term Foodmageddon. That will certainly stick in my mind. So thanks for sharing your remarkable experiment with us.
Thanks.
We have a lot of questions coming in. We're going to have one more speaker, and then we'll take about 10 minutes to discuss some questions. So our last speaker for this first set, for this first hour, is Cédric Carle of Atelier 21, the founder and director of this organization in France. Go right ahead.
I'm the director of Atelier 21. Atelier 21 is an NGO that is working on energy transition for a long time. And because we was looking for a long time about energy transition, about climate chaos versus resources, we find out that there was a lot of forgotten patterns in the history that was just sleeping. And we decided in 2015, before the COP21 in Paris, to make a website and to make crowdsourcing with a lot of people, expert and non-expert, to find out all these patterns about, energy uses and also food, water, mobility, and not only focusing on energy production as electricity or force. The goal of the project is to identify past and present frugal innovation, forgotten patents, and to put them in the for the public, for the engineers, for the energy makers and transitioners. So the Paleo Energetic is already 5 years of research and many invention exhumated. there is a volunteers and participant. It's already translated in 5 languages, as also Arabic and Japanese, Spanish. We have great researcher around us that is working with us. And also we like to work with retired people because they have a lot of knowledge, they have time, they have money, they are connected. So more and more we try to connect retired people around us to work with us on this topic. And here you can see the website is paleoenergetic.org. I think my friend can share it in the chat. And we find out a lot of crazy invention, old techniques that is already in public domain for a long time. And public domain means open source. And public domain means also that it's belonging to everybody. So here you can see the solar printer of Augustin Mouchot that is working, is a pioneer of solar energy, of solar concentration energy. We got this first Porsche was electric also. So to say like Corentin, we need narratives. And this project is a narrative that is showing that we are facing a big problem, climate chaos, resources problem, Ukrainian war, and we have solution already. So we don't have to wait for another technology. So it's a positive narrative that it is possible because we have now also fab labs. We can share a lot. We have mechanical engineers, and we are not like opposing, making opposition between high tech and low tech. We are facing an issue that is putting our society in danger. So we have to answer quickly, and the low tech, the retro tech, the public domain can be a response to that. Perhaps there will be also an high tech coming for batteries, I don't know. But we have to also take low tech and open source in the ground. So we are thinking also that we have to develop a business model based on open source and based on public domain, because it's a key to develop and to scale the all this network of knowledge. And sometimes our capitalistic world is not able to take this open source patent because they say, can I do money with open source? It's not possible. So after 5 years of research, we think that we need a workshop about open source economic model and to scale. And one of our economic model of us is to sell our books in French, in Japanese, and now in English. In English, it's called Retro Tech and Low Tech. All forgotten patents can shake the future, because we think it's a Pandora box in energy, but in water also. We are thinking already to make a paleo H2O. Because in water resources, we have so much problem that we have to exhumate a lot of resources and patents. So, of course, the idea is to talk with the people and to not make a war between low-tech and high-tech, because this is not constructive. We need to have a consensus on technology. We need to make techno-critics. We need techno-ethics, but we don't need to have two team. The team with the low-tech, the team with the high-tech, and the people, they make a war all together. So also, we have to critique, of course, innovation. We have to accelerate low-tech innovation if we can. So that's the goal of the project. And the project is a transmedia project. So there is the website, but also we have a timeline, a low-tech timeline that we can put in the for a workshop. And we ask the people to participate. We have different paper. White paper is an old invention. Green paper is what we are doing now. Is an ongoing project. A red paper is a bad ideas. So you know we are sharing best practices, but baddest practices we are not sharing it. But we have to blacklist some practice. So now we make this red paper, and the yellow paper is what we can do in a future in the. But in a quick future, because as the GIEC told, we have 3 years to make something for the climate. So we have to accelerate. So, and to accelerate, we have to have a goal. We have to have a schedule. So the project is also, we use the timeline and we use the schedule to 220 to 250. And we can make some step and write some step. So, for example, we got a consulting 2 weeks ago about GRDF, that is a big gas logistic company in France. And we have this project. I hope it will happen, that we have to see into the data of the patents. So the project is to put the people on the table, to put us, to put GRDF, and to put experts, and to scan in the patent office what is about biogas, what is about low-tech hydrogen, and what is about like what we can do with the gas, okay? So with the Ukrainian situation, the situation is now a real crisis. It's not perhaps we have a risk of missing energy or something, but no, it's the point. Our agriculture is under attack, and the resources, electricity here in France, and to warm the hospital and everything. This is a real topic for Europe now because of the gas and the petrol coming from Russia. And we've got our brother, I can say our master, Navi Raju, that is talking about frugal innovation. And he's talking also about our project. He said that we are making a circular economy of knowledge. And of course, there is a lot of patents sleeping in the patent office. I will not take a definition of low tech, but just to say it's a past challenge already. So it's an old story we are talking about. It's a story about crisis. We know the Earth, the World Earth Catalog. We know the limit of growth, limit to growth. We know the small is beautiful, that is talking about appropriate technologies. So it's an old story, but now it's perhaps time to scale. And I show you some example for the project. So we take back an old technique that is able to recharge non-rechargeable batteries. And it's an old patent. We take it back. No, it's called RegenBox. It's a DIY project. But no, the project is changing. It's a new scale now because we want to run a company and to make something for a regular product for the people. So in hydrogen, in direct combustion, we have a lot of example, old people making this during the Second World War. Really easily, really quickly, they retrofit a lot of vehicles with also gasogen and hydrogen. Air transportation, it's coming back. Also, the balloon is coming back because it's slow, it's really efficient, and you don't need a lot of infrastructure, of course, because you don't need so much road. You can go under the sea, under the mountain, and everything. And also to refreshing the buildings. There is a lot of old product coming from Mediterranean. And here, there is people, engineers, they are taking back this for the Tour Montparnasse in Paris, for the retrofit of the Tour Montparnasse. And they are using the turbulence of the wind to make ventilation inside the building. So it's a project to follow. And of course, there is the straw project, the straw buildings. The straw is a huge potential to insulate the building and to retrofit. And here you can see on the right, on the left, there is an old building in France. And I know in the United States, there is a lot of old building in straw. So it's a sort of really tradition also in the United States, in some part of United States. And on the right side, you can see a project where I was interior designer. It's Eco 46, and it's a project of an administration in Switzerland. And it's a project only for since 5 years. There is a dry toilet inside, almost zero plastic product inside, because we build everything with the wood in the commune. So really local wood, local products to be in maximum resilient. And to finish my presentation, we are looking for making a museum because we have a lot of archive now, picture books, old batteries, stuff like this. And the project of the Retrofuture Museum, because of the COVID, is waiting. Then we decide to make a street project, a sort of open museum in the street. So we make some printings with real size people, and with QR code, the people, they can scan it and they can make the three dimension the machine appear in the telephone or in the street. So here you can see it's our workshop in Paris. In front of the workshop, you have different paleo hero and heroine. You have the people and the big picture, and they can scan it and understand what is happening. So it's a part of our exhibition system, our transmedia project. Here you can see the process. Then you can scan the QR code, and then it makes the machine upon in 3D. And it comes also because we make a virtual museum, because we was in the COVID period. We was not able to welcome the people in the real in our real place. And then we design, we make 3D modeling, and we make a steering engine, hydraulic ram, solar concentration to melt metals. We make the 3D model of the solar printer of our friend Mouchot. There is the Edison car with the nickel iron batteries that was running 1,000 miles at the beginning of the century. So it's a really interesting project. Now this project is innovated by the Delft Institute of Technology also. So there is really interesting stuff that we exhumated with the crowd, with the people. And inside the museum, you have some audio guide that is that like this, you can hear the ghosts talking to you. And the idea is to make to take the ghost out of the cave, to take this high potential technical out of the cave, and thank you for your attention. And we are always waiting for new invention, new patent, new old patent. Thank you for everything.
Thank you so much, Cedric. We are just going to answer a few questions, and then we're going to give you a 5 minute break. Understanding that we have so much to talk about, we'll just take a quick break before we resume. But I do have a few questions that I picked from the chat for our speakers. The first one I have was for Corentin, asking if you could share an example of local entrepreneurship that you found interesting, and tell us whether you think that example might be applicable in a place like France or the US.
So we found many examples, like there are more than 50, and on the platform there are like more than 150. So there are many good examples, and it's true that the examples that are used in rich or poor countries, in countryside and in cities. And let's say, for example, in New York, because we are in New York, we met people that are growing spirulina You know, spirulina, it's a microalgae that you can eat. It's full of proteins and vitamins and minerals, and you can grow it very easily with a few resources. And it grows in New York, in Brooklyn. And it's we studied that in Madagascar because it was a very great project to help people, especially children, to eat better. And yeah, but difficult to sum up because there are so many examples. But yeah, about food, we have that. About communication, I was speaking about low-tech internet. About energy, biodigester can be used also in the cities. And treating water is also, like we do it in the boats, doable with phyto appreciation, like with plants and microorganisms. Yes, so there are many. And you can have a look at the website lowtechlab.org because there are many other examples.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This question is for Philippe. Asking if there are any tools or organizations that you think might help in implementing raw material constraints in industry.
I think there are some general resources that maybe we can share in the chat, like US Geophysical Survey. So now the International Energy Agency is providing many details on all the raw materials that are used in the various energy production systems. All types of PV solar systems, all types of windmills, all types of even hydro, everything is really well detailed. And I think that more and more companies try to, let's say, have an idea of their exposure to raw materials, because of course this can really be a problem in your supply chain. But it's quite difficult for them because the production is generally based on tier one subcontractors, and then tier two, tier three, tier four subcontractors. So it's not so easy for the moment. So except the very general resources, I think the British Geophysical Survey is also providing a few resources. But generally speaking, once we come to the industry, it often becomes secret business. Business secrets, so it's really difficult to get access to what are the right raw materials used in such or such and such device, and coming to very high tech products, it's also the generations are going so fast that once you have finished the first study, you are already not really at the point.
Yeah. Question for Scott: how can your project be scaled to support a small community? Any thoughts on that?
Well, my projects are only scaled for small communities. Right. So we don't advocate for anything anything on a national scale, right? Because right. Especially in America, everyone's such a rugged individualist, national scale things are difficult. Whereas when you do it in your community, it actually works better because you can see the results of it for yourself. It's the potatoes you grew. It's the tomatoes you grew. It's the corn that you grew, right? So it's easier, I think, on a smaller scale. And so, for example, we did it mostly for our household, but like I said, we grew over 1,000 potato plants because in addition to the Foodmageddon that we were doing as a study, COVID was happening. And I wrote to my family and said, you know, at what point are you going to leave Chicago and come out and stay with us? And they said, when there's no food in Chicago, because we didn't know in the beginning what was going to happen. And so, like I said, we grew thousands and thousands of pounds. And luckily, we were able to give it all to the food pantry. And so, you know, using green spaces, using these spaces around, we could grow a lot of food locally. And those are good on a small community scale, parts of parks, next to roads, places that are green spaces that aren't necessarily being used for food production, could be brought into production on a small community scale, and you could grow quite a lot of your food, even staples.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that's a question I could extend to to anyone in the group. You know, a lot of the examples that have been discussed are very well suited to small scale situations. You know, thinking about the numbers of people who may really benefit from some of these technologies. Do you have any thoughts about mindful scaling?
Yeah, maybe it's a key issue because it's Corentin was talking about the garage and the very sympathetic people making a few things, and it always looks like very micro scale, and what we need is of course at least a meso scale, something in the middle, or even a macro scale, and think about let's full systems of energy supply, for instance. So I think from my point of view, I think we need some energy, let's say, innovation from, let's say, people like the panelists we've seen, and it can inspire people, and there can be very interesting, very small and micro initiative. But at the end, I think that the this should be supported by the public authorities at the end, because the only way, why do we use so many high-tech things instead of low-tech? It's because they are quite practical and they are not expensive, and they are not expensive because they're content in energy, they're content in greenhouse gases, they're content in resources is not counted for real. I mean, it's not valued. I mean, in a smartphone, you have only €2 of metals, okay? The 40 different metals that we are spreading out and wasting after 2 years of utilization, it's only €2. So if there is no value to make it stay or be repaired and transmitted to the next generation or whatever for €2, nobody cares. So there is a question for me of public authorities, which should change the games of the rules of the game in terms of fiscal decisions, what should be taxed or not taxed, what should be subsidized, what should be supported in terms of also prescription. I mean, what the public companies, the public the local authorities and so on, they buy services, they buy products, and we could integrate things to support local initiatives, to support local supply chains, to support the services and products that are less impacting the environment. So for me, it's a mix of, let's say, citizen willingness, maybe enterprise companies' willingness, but I think enterprise is very difficult to take an initiative if your competitors don't. So it's better and easier if the public authorities support and change the rules of the game, and then all the companies will follow. That's a feeling, but it's maybe too much French centric.
Well, that actually ties into a question I had for Cedric about what role patent offices might play. Do you think that there's a role for particular institutions like the patent office to crowdsource and share innovations?
Of course, because to protect a patent, it's the states with doing this, so it's a public affair. Mm-hmm. So now there's public domain, so the public domain must be re-put in the front of the people, because it belongs to everybody. So it's like a Pandora box. It's a treasure, and we have to open the treasure. And now there is the people that, because of the high tech we have now, the digital power, we can digitalize all the archive, so it can give us the power to take it really quickly for the engineering school and for the innovation today for tackle climate change and resources problems. So I'm really sure the data, the patent office, have a role to play. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, given that it's 11:15 in Boston, 10:15 in Houston, I'm going to have us take a short 5-minute break before we move on to our second set of speakers, who are actually, we're already starting to reference some of these innovations that our second set of speakers are going to talk about in the chat, to offer some very concrete solutions. So please take 5 minutes. Feel free to continue chatting here on Zoom or get up from your computer, and we'll see you again in 5 minutes for a few more speakers. Thank you.
That's it for this extra long episode. Part 2 comes next week. The Low Tech Podcast is put out by the Low Technology Institute. At the moment, the show is hosted, edited, and distributed by me, Scott Johnson. This episode was recorded in the Low Technology Institute Institute. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and elsewhere. We hope you enjoyed this free podcast. And if you'd like to join the community and help support the work we do, please consider going to patreon.com/lowtechinstitute and signing up. The Low Technology Institute is a 501c3 research organization supported by members, grants, and underwriting. You can find out more information about the Low Technology Institute, membership, and underwriting at lowtechinstitute.org. Find us on social media, and you can reach me directly. I'm scott@lowtechinstitute.org. Our intro music was Early Sun, off the album Bittersweet Endings by Crowander. That song is under the Creative Commons Attribution and Non-Commercial License. Podcast is under the Creative Commons Attribution and Share Alike license, meaning you're free to use it and share it as long as you give us credit. Thanks, and take care.